You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, making one item of clothing is a global process, including cotton in Texas and factories maybe in China and Bangladesh. We'll talk to the author of a new book about how our clothes get made and the true cost of cheap clothing. Now, the Group of Seven Nations have a plan to change the way corporations are taxed. The deal would implement a 15% minimum tax rate for multinational corporations, and technology companies like Amazon and Google would be taxed wherever they make a profit, regardless of where their headquarters are. There have been accusations that the plan's unrealistic. Getting the seven nations to agree, let alone bringing other countries on board, will be challenging, and the U.S. might be a big hurdle, with top Republicans in Congress saying they're not on board. We're talking about G7's proposed tax reforms for global corporations, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think large global companies like Google and Facebook should pay taxes everywhere they make a profit, or only places where they're headquartered? Do you want to see companies work together to keep countries work together to keep companies from crossing borders to pay less in taxes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Stephen Rosenthal is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Can you outline this proposal? I won't call it a deal because it's not really a deal yet. Can you outline this proposal for us and what it changes?
Well, the Group of Seven tentatively agreed that there should be a minimum global tax rate so that wherever companies operated and profited, there should at least be a 15% minimum tax. And this is an agreement by the Group of Seven to go down this road to apply a minimum corporate tax of 15%. They still have some formalities, each of these seven countries, to formalize the agreement. And then more generally, they need to persuade a whole bunch of other countries, the G20 next month, and then a wider group of countries to participate. And this is important because the U.S. Recently reduced its tax rate, corporate tax rate, from 35 to 21, and lowered its tax rate for offshore profits to 10.5%. And that rate, 21% for domestic profits and 10.5% for foreign profits, was designed to generate more activity in the U.S. And in fact, we help participate in the race to the bottom to try to lower our corporate tax rates below those of some of our competitors in order to attract more business. And that race to the bottom has been going on for a couple of decades. We were a little behind in the race prior to our tax reform efforts in 2017, but now we've jumped to the lead. But Biden wants to increase corporate taxes to go back from 21 up to 28, halfway to where they were, 35, and then to increase the 10.5% rate for foreign profits to 21%. But if we increase our corporate tax rates at home, we risk losing some of our companies abroad and losing some business that we hope to attract from foreign countries here in the U.S. And the minimum tax creates a floor to reduce that pernicious competition, that race to the bottom.
How big a thing is it for companies to move their operations or some symbolic part of their operations to another country to pay a lower tax rate? I'm thinking we hear a lot about Ireland, for example, and so-called inversions. Is this a thing that's happening a lot?
Well, it's happened a lot more in recent years than ever before. If you go back a couple of decades, like to the 70s, the five largest U.S. companies, they made stuff. Computers, IBM, cars, GM, you know, Eastman Kodak made photography equipment and the like. They had factories in the U.S. and production here, a physical presence here. And so even when they sold abroad, it was pretty clear that their profits really originated in the U.S. And they really couldn't move when we raised their tax rates or kept them high. But in recent years, our economy's really shifted. We have a lot of digital companies and companies that have a lot of intangible assets and intellectual property. So the largest companies of today include Apple and Microsoft and Google and Amazon and Facebook. And so those operations are more easy to move. It doesn't take shifting a large factory. It just changes the location of some paperwork where intellectual property is owned, say, perhaps by an affiliate, and you write some internal contract. And so going back a few decades, this wasn't much of a problem of us worrying about competing with other countries because our companies really couldn't leave that easily. But in recent years, they have been leaving. And Obama put in place a variety of regulations to make it more prohibitive for U.S. companies to leave. Those were mainly stopgap types of efforts. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, that tax reform measure, took a different approach. Rather than sticks, it offered a lot of carrots. It just slashed U.S. corporate tax rates and competed very effectively in the race to the bottom. But that has its drawbacks. So yes, to answer your question, in today's economy, when so much is intellectual property and the globe is so much smaller now, supply chains, even for physical products, span the world. Clothing, for instance, can be manufactured in one jurisdiction and sold in another, and the fabric and the cotton can be grown yet somewhere else. And so we have an integrated planet, and operations are pretty seamless these days. And firm mobility is much greater now as a practical matter. And so the question is, can the tax laws compete and not be circumvented?
Talking to Steve Rosenthal from the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center about a new proposal agreed by the United States and six big economic partners to set minimum corporate tax standards. Now they've got to sell it, back at home, for one thing, here in the U.S., and to a bunch of other countries, too. You can join in if you have questions or thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, you said the race to the bottom, the idea of we're going to lower our corporate taxes to be more competitive for these businesses. You said it has drawbacks. Could you spell those out for us?
Well, it's hard to get anyone to agree to a large coordinated enterprise. It takes a lot of effort. And that G7 agreement was remarkable that we at least got seven countries to signal their intent of continuing down this path and selecting a minimum tax rate. But there are a lot of countries in the world, and we can't expect all of them to join the agreement. Although there are measures to punish any of the countries that try to attract business by undercutting, say, that 15% rate. And so coordinating internationally is a big challenge. And of course, our last president, Trump, did not believe in multilateralism, did not believe in coordinating. But Biden takes a different view. Biden believes in coordination globally, at least in some instances. And here is an example in which by setting a floor, 15% tax rate in foreign countries, and their taxes on their multinationals, we in effect free ourselves, give us more maneuverability to raise our tax rates. If we go from 15 to the full 28 that Biden has suggested, or even with preserving the 21% on the foreign piece of this, those are still numbers larger than 15%. However, the U.S. offers a lot of attractions to be here, the infrastructure, the educated workforce, the legal protections. And so we won't, so our efforts to attract business will not be undercut as dramatically when the floor is 15 as opposed to a floor of zero. And look, that's very important in my mind because we've lost a lot of revenue over the last few years in this race to the bottom. Corporate tax receipts pay very little, contribute very little to the infrastructure we have, to the educated workforce, to all the benefits that the corporations enjoy from operating here. And I think we ought to charge them more. And without a floor on foreign taxation and the race to the bottom to get to zero being present, we really are constrained in how much we can raise our tax rates. And we need those corporate taxes to fund the programs that all of us demand.
Steve Rosenthal is with us from the Brookings Institution Tax Policy Center. We're looking at a plan from the U.S. and six other leading economies to set a minimum tax level on multinational companies. I want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of, well, as things stand now, countries competing to lure businesses by lowering their corporate tax rates? Is that an okay state of affairs for you? Should the U.S. be competing with other countries by cutting corporate taxes? Or do you like this idea, this proposal that would coordinate between countries to say, hey, there's a floor, we're not going to go below that? You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the G7 tax proposal to set a floor, a minimum corporate tax level for everywhere, if possible. Steve Rosenthal is with us, senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts on this idea, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you worry that companies, in effect, evade taxes by moving from one country to another, whether it's actually moving operations or moving sort of a nominal headquarters? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, I want to talk about some key players, some at the table on this, some not. First of all, China, really big economy, not part of the G7. What are the thoughts on whether they would be excited about an idea like this?
Well, I think the Chinese are a puzzle. I don't think they've signaled much. I think the Chinese like to preserve as many tools for their economy as they can. But the question still is there whether or not they would want to cooperate. That's hard to say. And they're a very sizable country, commercial presence. You know, of course, I'm not sure China's a great substitute for the U.S. I think if I had a whole bunch of intangibles, I'd be a little more confident that the U.S. would protect them and the legal system here would guarantee that I could keep them versus, say, a completely different system like the Chinese. And so, again, they're a large presence, and it's unclear.
Another possible stumbling block closer to home. Republicans in Congress say they don't like this idea. They say it gives foreign countries influence on U.S. tax policy. They're worried about if we're still in the 20s and this floor is the 15s, that still doesn't sound that competitive. Can you talk about the politics in Congress over this?
Well, that's a real good question. I think that Republicans are framing this tentative agreement as a concession to allow foreign countries, in effect, to set our rates. But, of course, the foreign countries were already setting our rates by racing to the bottom and adopting, at least some of them, a beggar thy neighbor strategy. So I don't really give a lot of weight to the argument that we're somehow ceding a tax authority. That's sort of formalistic. The other argument that, well, 15% is a minimum tax is too low for, you know, corporate tax rates that will either be 28 or 21 if Biden's measures are enacted. Well, 15 is better than zero, so I'm not sure why we would stop at zero just because we could yet have trouble getting to the full 21% or 28%. That doesn't strike me as particularly plausible. But I think fundamentally the Republicans' concern is the flip side of the argument that I made. You know, in my mind, setting a floor on corporate taxes affords the U.S. Greater maneuverability and latitude to raise our own taxes and use those revenues to pay for needed social services. And likewise, it allows foreign countries like the French or the Germans to raise their rates and collect more from their corporations without fear of losing their corporations. But I think philosophically, the Republicans just object to corporate taxes, regardless of how much we need the financial resources. It's been decades since the Republicans have actually voted for a bill that raised taxes, net taxes, and the direction that the Republicans have gone most recently have been slashing corporate tax rates, going from 35 to 21%. And so as a consequence, I just don't think they want to see the U.S. raise taxes. But again, in my judgment, we need that revenue. There are so many services that we need, infrastructure, Social Security, you know, for an aging population. We need a revenue base to support the services that we need in the future. And we can only borrow and spend so long, in my judgment. And that's really what the last Republican tax bill did. It cut taxes and shifted to the future, the financial needs, you know, paying for the financial needs that will arise. At some point, we're going to have to pay for those, and we have to have a revenue base.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Mike?
I just wanted to bring up, I just read recently somewhere there was like the top 12 wealthiest people in America make so much money that you have to take the next 14.3 million Americans to match their wealth. And yet out of all of that, the top 12 only paid around, I think, $3 billion in taxes. Whereas the 14.3 million ended up paying 143 billion in taxes. So the wealth is just completely unequal and just off the charts. And then the taxes, like the middle class, the poor are still, you know, holding this country up on their shoulders while the wealthy are getting away with tax loopholes, with, you know, offshore accounts, with different things like that. The 2017 tax cuts, they slashed the taxes for the wealthy, for the corporations, and they gave this little tiny bit to the American middle class, which now is kind of being eaten away because as the tax law is written, over time, the middle class are actually going to end up paying more in taxes than they did before.
Mike, thanks for the call. Mike, getting into personal taxes, though some of the wealthiest people you mentioned own some of the corporations affected by the corporate tax policy we're talking about. But your thoughts, Steve, on Mike's belief that the taxes are out of balance, in effect.
Well, Mike is correct that the wealth inequities are dramatic in terms of how much the rich have. And then I think our tax rules largely compound the issue because the wealthy are different, say, than you and I. They own more capital, and we just tax their capital very lightly. Mike is probably referring to a report that just came out today by ProPublica mm-hmm. that somehow accessed tax information on the top several dozen Americans, individuals, all the richest Americans. And they could, you know, if you look to how they've done on the Fortune 50 list, their wealth is just growing in a staggering way each year, but they pay very few taxes. And that's largely because what they own are things like stock that appreciate, but until you sell them, you don't pay any taxes. And Warren Buffett is famous for not selling any of his Berkshire Hathaway stock, for instance. And so that's just one form of the way that capital is taxed very lightly. And one of the other problems, in my judgment, of our race to the bottom on corporate taxes is that the beneficiaries of corporate tax cuts in the short run are the shareholders. There's an argument that in the long run, some of the benefit will trickle down to workers. The long run could take 10 or 20 years. And we never really saw that when we cut the corporate taxes in 2017. We never saw benefits to the workers. What we see are benefits to the shareholders because after-tax profits rise and shareholder prices and share prices also rise. And if you look to who owns shares in our economy, the top 1% own more than half of the stock in our economy. And the bottom 50% own less than 1%. And so it's really skewed who owns stock and who benefits from cuts in corporate taxes. And again, I think I agree with Mike. Our tax rules have aggravated rather than mitigated some of the wealth inequality.
Mike, thanks for the call. Steve, in just our last minute or so, this is not a done deal by any means. Assuming things went well and it gets, like, what kind of timeline are we talking about to where we could have some kind of floor like this, this 15% corporate tax for many countries around the world?
Well, the G7 is going to take this up with a broader group of countries, the G20, in July, and we'll see how that goes. I don't think that should stop Biden from continuing down the path of trying to increase U.S. corporate taxes. That is, if there's the specter of a larger minimum tax, then companies are not going to flee today if a minimum tax is going to be enacted, say, next year even. So the pace of that minimum tax really is not so critical. In my judgment, what is critical is for us to start increasing taxes to pay for the services that we all are going to expect and want to see funded in the future.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Steve Rosenthal, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Tax Policy Center. He joined us today for a look at a plan that would set a minimum corporate tax around the world proposed by the U.S. and six other leading economies. Coming up, most big fashion brands would have a hard time telling you where exactly your clothing was made. That wasn't always the case. We'll talk to the author of the book Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, efforts to ban the teaching of critical race theory are multiplying around the country. What's driving these bans and what impact could it have on students and teachers? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, whether or not we've actually worn much of them in the last year, most of us have a few pairs of jeans in our closets. The average American woman apparently has seven. While we don't usually think about it when buying, that pair of jeans has been all over the world before we bought it, including maybe cotton farms in Texas, a stop in China where the fibers are spun and dyed, woven into denim, then maybe Sri Lanka or Bangladesh to be cut and sewn, before coming back to the U.S. to be shipped out to a buyer. Our next guest has been trying to find out more about who makes our clothes and the larger consequences for consumers, workers, and the planet. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made it a priority to try to buy clothes in a more sustainable way? Do you find it difficult to find sustainable and affordable options? Have you tried to find clothing with a Made in the U.S. label on it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maxine Beda is director of New Standard Institute, a nonprofit working with scientists and citizens to make the fashion industry more sustainable, ethical, and equitable. Her new book is called Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment. Maxine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's set the scene. You were for a little while trying to get into the clothing business, and you walked into a huge, huge clothing exhibition with a simple question for a lot of the sellers. Where did your clothing come from? What kind of answers did you get?
Yeah, this was at the convention center in New York, a very large convention center, and it's kind of the mall of all malls, basically, where buyers from across the country come together to plan their next collections, the retailers. And I went asking this very innocent question, you know, where do your products come from? And I got a lot of blank stares, a lot of people kind of throwing their hands in the air. I got vague answers like Asia. I got very bad answers like the Orient. And it just made me realize just how little the industry knows about its own story, its own history.
And even when I see a label that says made in China or Pakistan or something like that, really from your travels to the places from where the cotton is grown to where things are dyed and so on, a lot of our clothes are really multinational in origin. Can you talk about how hard it is to come up with one country to put on that label?
Yeah, it's very hard, and it's very misleading because, you know, your clothing is very rarely just made in one place. As you laid out in the beginning of the segment, the fiber might be grown in one place, then it's shipped halfway around the world to be spun and woven and dyed in another place, then probably shipped somewhere else to be cut and sewn, you know, to only then be shipped maybe around the world again to be sold to you. So it's very difficult to just put that one country on the map, and it ends up being kind of a legalese question as to what country it is actually sewn into the label.
So you set out to try to track one particular item of clothing, jeans, the ultimate American item of clothing, not made in America for the most part anymore. Why jeans in particular?
Yeah, jeans are such an iconic item. You know, I'm wearing them right now. I think, you know, as you said, most of us have a pair of jeans in our wardrobe. Over a billion are sold. Pairs are sold a year. And so, you know, it cuts across socioeconomic divides. It is this very much sign of Americana. And yet in the clothing industry more broadly, while in the 1960s, 95% of clothing that Americans wore was American made, today that is less than 2%. So our jeans kind of talk about, you know, the rise of our own industry and then its decline and kind of the consequences of all of that.
Talking to Maxine Beda, her new book is called Unravel, The Life and Death of a Garment. Well, I want to visit a couple of the stops that you took along the life path of a pair of jeans, starting in Texas. Apparently, we produce a lot of cotton in the United States and a lot of that in Texas. Can you start us off with the birthplace of so many jeans and the cotton grown there?
Yeah, so the U.S. is still a major producer of cotton globally. It's the third largest producer of cotton, and West Texas is kind of the heart of cotton country in the U.S. And so I spent time both with what is now called conventional cotton farmers and organic cotton farmers to understand better the decisions that have led them down that path. And what I learned, you know, from the organic cotton farmer, you know, Carl Pepper, he said he's a natural tinkerer. And that's why he was really willing to engage in something that was potentially very risky, because in the cotton fields, getting an organic certification takes 3 years. So a farmer has to invest and take risks and start doing things differently and doesn't see a benefit necessarily for another 3 years. So it was really important for me to understand, you know, if we want to move to a healthier agricultural system, the risks that farmers who already have a very, you know, risky profession, what it is that they're facing.
And now I want to go to China and Bangladesh, different parts of the lifespan there, and focus in on a particular issue, the environmental impact of what goes from turning that raw cotton into the clothes we wear, on water and more. Can you talk about some of the things you saw actually in both countries?
Yeah, so China is where most of the textiles globally are produced. And what people don't really connect with yet is just how much of a climate impact our clothing has. So the clothing industry has a higher carbon footprint than France, Germany, and the United Kingdom combined. It has an enormous impact, and that's because it takes a lot of steps, energy-intensive steps, at these mills to convert this raw fiber into a textile that we're actually going to wear. And the additional challenge is that we're producing these jeans or these clothing in countries with very cheap energy. And, you know, globally, that cheap energy means coal energy. So we're using the dirtiest forms of energy to create a very energy intensive process. And so resultingly, you have this industry that has just an enormous greenhouse gas emitter. In addition to the chemical pollution that it results in, and the plastic pollution, because today in clothing, the number one dominant fiber is polyester, which is a plastic based product. So it's, you know, the environmental impact is enormous and cuts across many different areas.
And then you visited, among other places, places in Bangladesh where those textiles are turned into the final product, the clothes we end up wearing. Can you talk about the experience of the workers you saw in action there and who you visited actually at their homes?
Yeah, so I got a chance both to see garment workers, you know, in action, working at production lines, and then follow those workers into their own homes. And I think the thing to keep in mind with clothing production is that it hasn't really changed in the last 100 years. So I certainly took my clothing for granted. But when you walk into a cut and sew facility, it's rows and rows and rows and rows of people, up to 40 people on a line producing a single garment. So they're all sitting behind sewing machines and they're responsible for just one element. And it's made the most efficient system with industrial engineering so that a worker is just doing the same process over and over and over and over and over again. And the very difficult part engaging in this subject is that I learned that this industrial engineering actually got its start on the cotton plantations in the South during the time of slavery. So it's this same approach of really trying to get the most out of a human. And then, of course, we're now moving to this space where the human is being replaced by a machine. And then, you know, just following that garment worker, you know, I was really curious to understand what are they thinking about, you know, during their day. And, you know, the woman responded to me, "I feel like I'm in a prison." And she said she didn't get, you know, she doesn't have time to think about her life. She's just constantly thinking throughout the whole day, don't make a mistake, keep going faster, don't make a mistake, keep going faster. And I think we really have to think about that really kind of devastating, mind-numbing work, in addition to the very low pay. And this woman, I was in her home, the size of my bathroom, you know, in a New York apartment that fit her and her husband and two children. So kind of, you know, while the bosses at the top are kind of some of the wealthiest people in the whole world. So that was kind of the dynamic that I was able to see while I was there.
We're talking to Maxine Beda, director of the New Standard Institute, author of the new book, Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how clothing is made? Would more transparency from companies make you more likely to buy their clothes? Transparency about where their clothes are made, what the conditions are for workers, the environmental impact. What do you want from brands? Do you think about these things when you are shopping for an item of clothing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Maxine Beda, director of the New Standard Institute, author of the new book, Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment, looking at a huge industry, the clothing industry, an invisible industry in many ways. We buy the clothing, but the story of how it gets to us is often below the surface. You could join in with your questions and your thoughts on how you shop for clothing at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I heard the opening introduction. It reminded me of an essay. I think it was called iPencil. And I'm not sure if it was the great Dr. Friedman that came up with it, but I heard it from him. And it just talked about how no one knows how to make a pencil. You know, where does the rubber actually come from and what goes into that making that rubber? What about the little metal clip and the the wood and the lead and everything that goes into it. And it's just amazing how all these different organizations and each person getting a better life as a result of making it, no matter what part of the world that you're in, and all comes down and shipped to a store in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, for me to buy, whether it's jeans or a pencil. And it's just amazing that everyone's life is enriched as a result of having that job and that opportunity.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, as far as the mechanical side of that, Maxine, yes, the pieces may come from a lot of the countries. Is everyone's life enriched by the opportunity to participate in this system of making the clothing?
Yeah, Steve, thank you for your call. I think, you know, what I uncovered is, you know, just how unequal the system actually is. And so there has been research on whether these garment worker jobs and the distribution jobs as well, that's closer to home in the United States, whether it's actually improving people's lives. And the research is not straightforward on that. So I think, you know, part of the point of the book is, you know, how we can actually make these jobs, good quality jobs that people actually receive a living wage, because there's no evidence of garment workers receiving a living wage that would allow them to feed their children, to educate their children. But we can move to that place. And I would agree with the caller on this, that it should be a system and can be a system, but we would need to change it from what it is right now.
Steve, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Maxine, you write that there's such a system of outsourcing and middlemen and that kind of thing, to where a big brand name like, say, Levi's doesn't actually do much in the way of making a pair of jeans. They're more of a marketing entity. How does that affect accountability when we have these tragedies like one in Bangladesh or stories of abuses of workers?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a big thing when we started outsourcing our clothing production is that the institutions that we fought to create, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency, which came about in part from when we saw in our own rivers that they were dyed the color of the latest textile trend, that is what led in the United States to develop things like the Environmental Protection Agency. It was women garment workers in the United States that fought for basic labor protections, including things like the concept of the weekend. So when we outsourced this, we did not include these protections in our international trade agreements. We essentially just created this race to the bottom for the lowest, you know, to move to countries of production that have the lowest wages and the lowest environmental protections. And so I argue in the book that we really need to rebuild up those institutions globally and put them in our trade agreements so that we can have this a race to the top and not a race to the bottom.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Eau Claire. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for answering my call. Two quick things. One, having lived in Madrid for 4 years, two things. One, I'm wondering to what degree do the United States garment makers go to foreign countries to know how to get the highest quality out of their clothes? For example, having been in Marrakesh, the dye in Marrakesh was unbelievable, both in the clothing and in the leather industry. So that's one thing. To what degree do we go to find out how do they make this incredible dye? The second thing is traveling Europe. To what degree does the clothing industry look at the styles? Having lived in Madrid for 4 years, they were 3 years ahead of us in style. And so I'm wondering, both in the quality and in the style of garments, to what degree do we search that out in the United States so that we can be the leaders and not having other countries?
Well, Jim, thanks for the call. Your thoughts on that, Maxine? We don't make a lot of clothing in the United States these days, for starters.
Yeah, exactly. We're not making much of it anymore. And so a company like Levi's that once owned factories, and the original idea of brands started out from factory owners, you know, trying to demonstrate the quality of their products. But, you know, as globalization rolled out and was pushed, these companies completely switched how they operated. So a company like Levi's, which owned factories, stopped owning factories altogether. They don't produce any clothing. They are in the business of marketing, maybe designing, but not all the time. You know, they're products that are made, you know, far, far away. So, yes, you know, the whole industry as a result has become global in terms of chasing the latest style, chasing the cheapest production. But we're not going to that, searching for that place of quality, which is what I argue in the book. We really need to turn to is to focus back on quality that we once had.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Maxine Beda. Her new book is Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment. We took just a whirlwind tour. You went to a lot more places and dug in more. I want to get to some of your recommendations, especially for clothing consumers, Maxine. What kind of things are you hoping people come away from your book thinking about as they think about when and how they buy clothing?
Yes. So, you know, I spoke to a lot of shoppers, you know, about their own relationship to clothing. And I think that, you know, I'm an older millennial, but I spoke to millennials and also Gen Z. And there's just this incredible shift that people need to know about in terms of the exposure to the number of ads that young people are exposed to. So 50 years ago, people were exposed to about 500 ads a day. Today, they're exposed to up to 10,000 ads a day. So we're being bombarded with these messages to shop more, to buy more. And it's really problematic for the environment. As a result, our wardrobe doubling in size. We buy twice as much clothing and wear it at half the time than a generation ago. So there's this real shift. There's a survey that came out that 1 in 3 young women consider clothing old after wearing it only once or twice. So that's the relationship that we need to start to think about with our clothing. You know, if we want to live in a thriving planet, it's really as simple as that. And so the idea is to take back control, like from the messages that are being sent to us, and have a really build a relationship of, you know, of real love and appreciation for all that has gone into the clothing. And I think that's the place, you know, that we can be more sustainable, is if we reconnect to our clothing, understand its history and appreciate it more, the more we will wear that clothing, and the more we wear it, that's the greatest driver of resource reduction use. So that's going to be the most sustainable thing we can do, is to wear our clothing more and to really love it.
And briefly, you also suggest some policy changes. Can you share something that's at the top of your list that might make a difference?
Yeah. So in terms of policy, and what I chart out in the book is just how much it's been an American policy to actually get people to see themselves as consumers versus citizens. And so by actually showing that history, we can kind of regain our identity as citizens and move this policy. And kind of one of the biggest areas of policy is work around kind of unions as a way to increase wages. And then to build back those, or to build for the first time in an international context, requirements that the standards that we have in the U.S. are the standards that we would expect globally. And that would be a benefit for the environment in total, and also would be a benefit for American workers. So we're not putting American workers, pitting them against the very cheapest labor elsewhere. We can really have a level playing field. And that's the work that we're doing now at the New Standard Institute.
Maxine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Maxine Beda, director of the New Standard Institute, a nonprofit working with scientists and citizens aimed at making the fashion industry more sustainable, ethical, and equitable. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Unraveled, The Life and Death of a Garment. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, many people have been working or learning remotely. Some of them don't want to go back. The author of the new book, Remote Inc., tells us how to make the most of working online. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, fresh brewed root beer, custard, shakes, broiled burgers, all in the comfort of your car. We'll talk about the drive-in restaurants around the state you can visit this summer to get some good eats. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.